Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert, filling in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we've seen it all before. The music starts, the crowd roars, and then the candidates make their big entrance. But picking that perfect campaign theme song can be a landmine. Ronald Reagan used Born in the USA until the boss shut him down and asked him to stop using it. And Hillary Clinton, she got flack for using Captain Jack when she ran in New York. It had some unsavory references that didn't go unmissed by a lot of people. This hour, we'll dissect the campaign theme song and take a listen from John McCain's Take a Chance on Me by ABBA to Move On Up for Barack Obama. This hour, call us up and tell us what your favorite campaign songs have been, why you like them, and what isn't working for you on the campaign trail. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our guests this hour are Mark Clegg, Assistant Professor of Musicology and American Culture from the University of Michigan, and Courtney Brown, Professor of the Department for Political Science, Emory University, and author of Politics in Music, Political Transformation from Beethoven to Hip Hop. And let's go ahead and see Mark Clegg. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, Veronica.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks so much for the invitation to speak with you today.
Mark Clegg, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us what you think it takes to make a great campaign theme song?
Well, I think the main importance to campaign songs, particularly today, is just to get people excited about a candidate. And so actually, it's probably less about lyrics these days than it is about the energy that comes off a song. A lot of candidates are choosing to use songs that are already popular, that are already hits, and trying to associate themselves with the energy and the fan base that those songs have even before they became a candidate. So, you know, something like, you know, Bill Clinton and using, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, you know, and using that Fleetwood Mac tune as a way of sort of connecting not only the ideas and sort of these main issues about change, of wanting something new, and the idea of youth and energy really came across in that song, and I think made it a very successful song for him. So I think the songs, the energy and the motivation of your political supporters is probably where things are at these days, in contrast to what songs were, say, in the 19th century, when it was really just about getting name recognition, about putting maybe some basic issues on the table.
I was in college when Bill Clinton started using Don't Stop when he was running, and that was the first time that it really sort of entered my consciousness that there were these campaign theme songs. It seemed like kind of a hip thing to do to me, to be using a rock song, but he wasn't really the first to do that, was he?
No, actually, the first songs go back to the colonial days, I mean, in city government in New York. But the sort of earliest campaign songs really were songs celebrating military victory, you know, even trying to convince George Washington to become a candidate. The sort of notion of songs in electoral politics go back that far, to before the first president of the United States. And it really didn't become a big deal until sort of the party machine started getting going, the sort of modern election where you had political parties that were out drumming up votes and trying to get people to go to the polls. I mean, initially in the United States, the Electoral College, the electors were largely chosen by state legislatures. So even into the 1820s, you know, getting people to vote was not really a big deal. By the presidency of Andrew Jackson, when he got sort of the party machine going, and particularly the sort of watershed moment is 1840 with the Tippecanoe and Tyler II election, where William Henry Harrison uses that song, Tip and Tie, to really engineer himself as a sort of homespun, log cabin, hard cider kind of candidate, which really wasn't true at all. I mean, he was a fairly elite, you know, professional politician who sort of created this pioneering image to get people in the fringes of American culture, sort of the farmers and the pioneers, to come in and support him. And that's when national elections and campaign songs really became essential.
And now, though, most of the candidates, well, I think all of them are using, I'm not going to say canned songs, but pre-existing songs that are already out there.
Well, there's one really interesting change going on, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't mean to say that music, campaign music, is less important, it's probably more important today than ever, in the sense that so much of our coverage of candidates is multimedia. You know, things on television or YouTube, it all has music behind it. But yeah, they're cheesing songs that are already there. But one of the interesting new things is where actual supporters, where individual voters are writing their own songs, uploading them to YouTube, and trying to get, you know, their message and supporting a candidate, sort of a song that's outside of the control of the party or the candidate's own staff.
I'm going to go ahead now and pick up Courtney Brown, who's been standing by. Courtney Brown, professor at the Department of Political Science at Emory University and author of the book Politics and Music, Political Transformation from Beethoven to Hip Hop. Courtney Brown, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm glad to join you and Mark.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. Tell me, do you have a favorite campaign theme song this time around, one that really works for you or that you think is working?
Well, when you say, is it working, there's two aspects to it. There's two types of political music. There's representational political music, where the song actually represents what the composer actually wanted it to represent in terms of political stuff. And then there's associational, where the song, regardless of what the composer originally wanted, is being associated with, as Mark was talking about, a political idea. And so if you're to say, what is my favorite, you'd have to say, well, are we talking my favorite song that was representing what the composer actually intended it to do, or was it associational, which is whether it's being hijacked, essentially, and being used in a way that the composer may or may not have wanted it to do. If you were to say my favorite representational piece of political music, I guess you'd have to say Wellington's Victory, which was composed by Beethoven in celebration of the defeat of Napoleon by the British forces. And so this type of representational political music goes back, you know, a long way. In terms of associational stuff, you've already made some good examples. Bill Clinton's example, recent examples, such as Lee Greenwood's popular song, God Bless the USA, that was used by Ronald Reagan in his campaign and on a commercial that he was using in 1984. And similarly, Elton Britt's hit, There's a Star-Spangled Banner waving somewhere. That was also used a lot during World War II. In terms of classic songs that have been used for associational purposes, those are really sort of some of the best examples. So if you go far back, Wellington's Victory, if you go more recent into some of the Reagan stuff, God Bless the USA and Elton Britt song, There's a Star-Spangled Banner Waving Somewhere, which was a World War II hit.
Well, it's hard to argue with Beethoven. That's got to be classic no matter what you do. But let's listen to one that's in play right now. This is one, we'll see if you recognize it, see how the branding worked there. This comes from John Cougar Mellencamp. Let's listen. Well, did you think of a Chevy truck, or did you think of somebody else?
Well, I was worried you were going to ask me to talk about a candidate, and all I could think of was the truck.
That's been the criticism of that one. Can anybody tell me whose song that was?
Well, you said it was Mellencamp, right?
It's Mellencamp, but do you know who used it in the campaign? Mark Clegg, do you want to take a swing?
I have no idea.
That would have been John Edwards' song.
Wow.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of use of patriotic type songs by campaigns. It's a very popular thing. You know, Mark was also talking about the type of music you get that's where it's not a particular song, but it's a genre. So it's a type of music, such as country rock, is very popular to use in some songs in some TV commercials. For example, Barack Obama has one of his first out of the box commercials that was playing recently in Virginia. In West Virginia, as well as repackaged a variety of places elsewhere, that used some country western motif in the back, but it wasn't necessarily a particular song. But it was referencing, in an associational way, the patriotic component of country music.
Well, country music seems like, certainly for the Republican candidates, you mentioned, a really good way to sort of drive home that I'm from the land, I'm one of you, I come from this country sort of message.
Yeah, actually, there's a huge number of very patriotic and clearly representational songs. For example, Daryl Worley, Have You Forgotten? That was the 2003 hit that was after the Iraq War was just started. And then you have Alan Jackson talking about things like Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning, referencing to the September 11 attacks. What happens with country music is it comes out of a historical tradition of putting ballads where there are stories in them. They're not just love songs, they're actual stories. And it goes back, actually, to early immigrants coming in from Scotland and some other parts of Europe, where they used to have an oral tradition, and they used to tell their stories of their lives, their families, their whatever happened in the history. And so country music has a long-standing tradition of putting stories into their music. And so that's why it's so easy to have country music tell these patriotic stories, and especially of heroic type of deeds and so on.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, and another point I think it's important is that pop music in general, but country music especially, has this effect of the individual speaking from the heart directly to the listener, and there's a kind of illusion of communication from the artist, or you know, almost as a friend directly to the listener. And so in order to wrap that into political music, where it seems like you're having a personal relationship with the artist or with the candidate through the music, as a way of getting away from the mass media, you know, sort of national, very distant aspects of contemporary campaigns, and trying to personalize the message. And one of the interesting things that Courtney's point about the, you know, country music, particularly in southern states, and country music is really popular here in Ann Arbor, Michigan as well. But I think a lot of candidates are using different soundscapes. They use different songs in different parts of the country, or when speaking with different communities, to target very specific groups, you know, maybe Hispanic groups or African American groups, or, you know, that use music again as a way of connecting with individual voters. And so, and in some ways, it's not so much the campaign song, but the set, it's like a playlist that's then adapted for very specific purposes. And so we don't hear a lot of talk right now about the single campaign song of certain candidates, anyway, maybe with the exception of Hillary Clinton and Celine Dion, You and I. But a lot of the other candidates are sort of, I think, trying songs out and trying them with different communities.
You know, that's a really interesting point Mark is mentioning about the sort of the niche market now for political songs. Perhaps one of the reasons, I'm sort of guessing here, but perhaps one of the reasons that we see this phenomena happening in this particular campaign is that the Iraq War is becoming less and less the lead story of every single day. And so we have more of a freedom now to think about other things, think about the economy, think about other troubles that people are having in their lives. And so this niche music that is able to address more particular aspects is having greater opportunity.
Well, I want to listen to one that someone who's doing the music very differently. He's the only one using soul music. You can guess this is Barack Obama. And it seems to be working pretty well for him. In the critiques that I have read, pretty much everyone had a song which was could be a serious liability, but his seemed not to be so bad in terms of the content. Let's take a listen to this one. This is used in the campaign by Barack Obama. So obviously the operative line there, signed, sealed, delivered, I'm yours.
Yeah.
And the only critique I've heard about this particular selection by Barack Obama is that maybe it's a little too presumptuous. Here I am, as though he's already sealed the deal, but it's funky, it's got a nice groove, and it seems to kind of separate him from the other music that's out there. What do you think, Mark Clegg?
Well, that's really interesting, because I've been curious about, you know, when certain certain musics have been sort of off limits, and I think hip hop is one of those musics that is sort of off limits right now as far as political campaign songs. Nobody wants to get associated with the negative issues that a lot of at least mainstream, very popular hip hop has. And so this sort of, then there's this illusion in American culture that there's this great homogenous sort of assumed to be white middle class. And so by using soul and actually evoking a sort of African American soundscape, he's, I mean, saying something very obvious. And so I think in some ways, you know, his racial identity, which for a long time was very much in the background of his campaign rhetoric. I mean, the other thing is using sort of a Motown artist, sort of Stevie Wonder, is a pretty safe way to go as far as getting into this issue and introducing it to American culture. I mean, Motown very much was a way of bringing the African-American aesthetic into the white mainstream. And so it's interesting that he would be moving, using exactly the same voice to sort of bring that idea up very carefully and gradually.
We're going to take a quick break now. We're talking with Mark Clegg, Assistant Professor of Musicology and American Culture at the University of Michigan, and with Courtney Brown, Professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University, author of the book Politics in Music, Political Transformation from Beethoven to Hip Hop. I hope you'll join in our conversation this hour. Have you been paying attention to the campaign theme songs, and how are they working for you? Do you remember a song maybe from the past that stuck with you that you thought did a good job of summarizing what a candidate was all about and maybe had a good groove as well? Give us a call this hour at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Past noon on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic by Joseph J. Ellis.
His mother told him, someday you will be a man, and you will be the leader of a big old band. Many people coming from miles around to hear you play your music.
Johnny Be Good, the campaign theme song for, you guessed it, John McCain. Another one with a nice groove and, you know, not a complex message there. He's just trying to get the name John McCain to stick in your head. I think he's done a pretty good job. What do you think, Courtney Brown?
Well, that one worked. That was a classic situation of music being used sort of loosely just for getting the name stick in your head, like you were saying before. The range of music that you'll see right now in the current campaign is going to be very wide just because of things like that. In other campaigns where there's been more of a central focus on one issue, then you're going to get music that's much less diversified and much more focused.
Can you give me an example?
Well, sure. Right after the 2004 elections, for example, right after the 9-1-1 stuff, Toby Keith came out with his song Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American, and that was a classic song that was in response to the 2001 attacks, but this is going back to what Mark was saying. You have an ability to have a personal relationship developed between the audience and the songwriter and the performer because of something shared. In this case, it was shared anger.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, anger was really infused throughout the American populace, and so an angry song like that really, really resonated. In a situation like today, that anger has diminished very considerably, so a song like Toby Keith's song, Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, that just wouldn't resonate, and you wouldn't find people using it in such a situation.
I want to go and take a couple of phone calls now. We have Jim from Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. You were mentioning songs before. My favorite was Walter Mondale, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Teach Your Children Well.
Mm.
That was sort of like the Surrender commercial, I think. He knew it was over. But that was like a parting thought, I think. But I have two questions for your guests. First, have they ever heard of a time where an artist or maybe a record company was upset that someone was using their song and they didn't agree with their politics and they didn't want to be associated. And the second question is, do these candidates pay royalties for using these music?
Thanks for those questions, Jim. And I do know of one. I'll let our guests answer, too, of course. But Ronald Reagan was asked to stop using Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. So that's one example. What do you think, Mark Clegg and Courtney Brown?
Well, there are a couple other issues, or a couple other times I can think of. In 96, Bob Dole was using another soul tune, Soul Man, which he, a lot of times what candidates will do is substitute a couple words, and in this case it's, again, an appeal for both hipness and name recognition, which, so Dole was using, substituted Dole for Soul, and so had the Dole Man song, and Isaac Hayes apparently wasn't too happy about that. And then actually, Tom Petty, just on the Super Bowl, one of the songs he performed on halftime was I Won't Back Down, and George W. Bush in 2000 was using that song, and Petty, you know, asked him to stop using it. So it's actually pretty typical and is often seen as sort of a Republican-Democrat issue because artists are generally associated with the more liberal, left-leaning politics. And I mean, this is not universally true, but the when this does come up, you know, and it tends to be with Republican candidates.
Well, thank you for that call, Jim. And let's take a call from David, calling from Milwaukee. Hello, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually a folk singer, and I'll be performing at some of the Obama rallies.
Oh, great.
And standard folk music trick, and you just mentioned it with Dole Man, is you take a familiar song to people which has a message and adjust the verses to really send the message out. And in this case, I'm using Dion DiMucci's Abraham, Martin, and John with an added verse for Obama that he's following the dream of Abraham, Martin, and John.
Hmm.
That's great.
Mm. That's a good one. So have you sung for him before, or is this upcoming?
This is upcoming. But I've sung at many, many political events.
Now, do his people want to vet your verse, or are they just giving you carte blanche to go ahead?
We call that in the business folk process.
Full process.
Which is called plagiarism in any other venue where you actually make any money doing it. But we're not, you know, people aren't going to sue us. But I do feel that if you record the song or you are, you know, if you're making money off it, yeah, you should pay royalties to the original composer.
One of the factors there is with recording rights is that there's a, you know, a standard licensing fee to do recordings, which is sort of mandated by law. And so you don't actually have to go through individual negotiations with every artist. You can just lease things, you know, from record companies. And so it's relatively common, although I have a sense that, you know, most of this stuff happens in an underground economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that call, David from Milwaukee, and good luck with your Obama gig. And let's listen to another song here. This is one that was used for the Ross Perot campaign. I'm guessing it might be one that wasn't so effective. See what you think.
Wondering what in the thinking that my love could hold you. I'm crazy for trying and crazy for...
So the prevailing word there being crazy, I'm not sure what to think about how that worked for him.
Well, that was a very low-energy song, and that's not exactly what Ross Perot needed at that time. He needed a lot more energy. You know, something I might add to the conversation you were saying before about when people use songs that are already there and change the lyrics, that actually goes back a long, long way. Joe Hill, for example, he used to write labor songs that were using old tunes that everybody knew and simply changed the lyrics to reflect union organizing stuff that he wanted to promote. And then also, like Leonard Bernstein, when the Berlin Wall fell down and East and West Germany collapsed into one, he had a historic performance of the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and the Ode to Joy he changed to the Ode to Freedom, and wherever the word joy appeared in the choral, he changed it to freedom. So, you know, this idea of taking music and associating it with a different political idea, and then putting some changes in the words, that's been around for a long time.
How about classical music? Has that been used at all in current campaigns?
Well, Mark, maybe you would have more about. I don't know of too many examples of classical music. I know classical music has been used historically a tremendous amount, but not in current campaigns. Historically, it was used, for example, during the Weimar Republic. Everybody was using classical music in different forms, both Wagner as well as Beethoven. And especially during the Nazi period, Germany was using Wagner and Beethoven tremendously and trying to associate it with their particular movement. So classical music historically has been used a lot, but today it doesn't really resonate. Classical music is, in terms of the masses, is basically something you hear on public radio, and the audience for it is very small. So it's not something you're going to see in campaign tunes.
I guess in this campaign, the closest I've heard to classical music has been the theme to Rocky, which I think was used by, I'm going to get it wrong maybe, but I thought it was Rudy Giuliani. I'll check in on that.
Mm-hmm.
It was Rudy Giuliani.
I can say that there have, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, in the United States, there were actually sort of whole record albums, LPs, that were put out that would be like the favorite classical music of Dwight Eisenhower and, you know, Truman and whatnot. And so there was especially when orchestras were really being built up in the United States sort of in mid-century, and there was a lot of enthusiasm behind classical music, and it was seen as, you know, intelligent and very sort of, not so much highbrow, but as about, you know, reaching for the best. And I think that there was, at least within certain constituencies, like Decca Records or record companies would put out entire albums of a candidate's favorite classical music. And that would be sold, again, in a niche market. It wouldn't be a national thing. I mean, another reason you don't have, you know, Beethoven symphonies at political campaign rallies is you have to hire 100 people. You know, it's a lot easier to have a folk singer and, you know, guitar to really be able to put out that kind of music. So it's, as far as live performance, it would discourage classical music from being used.
Well, one thing that Mike Huckabee has done, he plays bass, and he actually performs with a band in his home state, but he has been hiring local musicians all along the way and sitting in with them, which seems like a really kind of fresh take on campaign music. And he's been leaving the campaign songs up to them pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea as far as, and of course Bill Clinton did it with saxophone, and it actually, there's a longer history even. I'm trying to remember his name. The running mate for George Wallace, another third party candidate, was a folk singer as well and would perform on the campaign trail. And I think there's a kind of a hipness and appeal to youth that happens from being a musician, and maybe also a sort of, especially in a campaign that's looking for change, a sense of being a little different than the average Washington insider if you're also a musician.
Let's take another call now. Here is Sheila talking to us from Zion. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wanted to call and add, to see if the guests on your show have heard of the song "Yes We Can." I guess you consider that a youth movement song. It was put together by a group of artists, singers, and actors and actresses, and right now it's like the number one viral on the internet. And I was just wondering if they had an opportunity to hear it.
Has that been used politically, Sheila?
It has not been used politically. You know what? Let me rephrase that. At the rally that they gave in California this past weekend, I think the Obama campaign used that particular song.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a YouTube video for Barack Obama using the song "Yes We Can" as well.
That's the one I'm referring to. I believe it was taken from the speech that he had given after his New Hampshire loss. And it's an amazing song, and I thought it was one of those watershed moments that, you know, my 16-year-old son said it made him shiver after listening to it. So,
who did you say wrote the song?
Will I Am from the Black Eyed Peas.
Will I Am, Black Eyed Peas, okay.
Scarlett Johansson is in it, Herbie Hancock, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, there's just a ton of different artists who all put this together without any input from the Obama campaign. They felt they were super inspired, put it together in a couple of days, actually.
That sounds awesome. We'll have to look that up at some point. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Sheila.
Thank you.
And we have time to listen to another one now. Let's take a listen to this one and see if it rings any bells.
A little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mind and open up your heart and maybe satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Baby, close your eyes and listen to the music. Dig to the summer breeze. It's a groovy night and I can show you how to use it. To come along with me and put your mind at ease. Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action.
A little less conversation, I guess, is the prevailing theme there. Mitt Romney saying he wants to get things done, take care of business, and not so much with the talking anymore. How do you think that one works, Courtney Brown?
Well, actually, that's probably a good theme for the Romney campaign, because he's really running as the corporate candidate, as someone who knows business. And that particular song is interesting. It's a mashup, of course, of an early Elvis Presley tune. Elvis Presley has been involved in political songs for a long time. His classic, of course, is An American Trilogy that includes pieces like Dixieland and Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. And it's going back to a tradition that Elvis Presley started a long time ago. It's an interesting use of that song, because that song is clearly, the song that you just played, the mashup, is clearly not representational political music, meaning there's clearly no original political content in the music. It's clearly a situation of Romney trying to make an association between himself and some message that he's trying to promote. And it's not a bad song, very catchy.
He's got a pretty good playlist, actually, just to give you a sense of some of the other songs that Mitt Romney's using. He also uses Simple Man by Lynyrd Skynyrd, More Than a Feeling by Boston, Don't Stop Believin' by Journey, and You Ain't Seen Nothin' Yet by BTO. So a lot of good songs on his list, and there don't seem to be too many clunkers there. What do you think about Mitt Romney's playlist, Mark Clegg?
Well, I think it just speaks to this sort of wanting to reach out to lots of different candidates, different voters. And what really strikes me about the Elvis Presley mashup is this, just the energy that comes off of it. And I think Romney has been accused of being a little bit too straight-faced, a little bit too statue-esque, and him wanting to show a little looser, you know, vibe. And so taking an American rock icon like Elvis Presley, who is sort of known for, you know, rather than being you know, statuesque for swinging his hips and moving across the stage, you know, is a way of a sort of energizing his image as well.
I'm going to take a quick break now, and then we'll be back with more talk about campaign theme songs this hour. We're talking with Mark Clegg, Assistant Professor of Musicology and American Culture at the University of Michigan, and with Courtney Brown. He's Professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University and author of the book Politics in Music, Political Transformation from Beethoven to Hip Hop. And we have some open lines right now, one for you. I hope you'll give us a call and tell us what campaign songs are working for you. If you're curious about what candidates are using, we have a lot of resources here to check that out, too, and we'll be listening to more clips. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Tell us what's working for you and what isn't in the world of the campaign theme song. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 7 tonight, we bring you special Super Tuesday primary election coverage from NPR. As the polls close across the nation, hear election results and analysis. Your hosts tonight are Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Scott Simon, and Andrea Seabrook. And then tomorrow morning between 6 and 9, Joy Cardine and her guests discuss Super Tuesday results and whether Wisconsin is still a factor in the race for the White House. Veronica Rickert, back with you today. I'm filling in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the campaign theme song today, this hour, and deciding which songs are working for which candidates and taking a look back as well. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. We haven't, Mark Clegg and Courtney Brown, touched on Hillary Clinton's music. We don't have any clips of her music, unfortunately, but she has had a little bit of controversy. She did something which probably seemed like a pretty good idea initially. She asked for help picking a campaign theme song, and The song that won was a Celine Dion song called You and I. Are you guys familiar with that song?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you characterize it for me? How would you describe it?
Well, there's been some criticism of the song of sort of outsourcing her campaign music because Celine Dion was born in Canada rather than the United States. And the music, I think, taps into this sort of general current of wanting change, of looking for optimism. There's a lot of connections, especially in the lyrics, with sort of the ideas that sort of associate with American popular song and American patriotic song, this idea of sort of the from sea to shining sea in the mountains. And so the opening line is, high above the mountains, far across the sea, I can hear your voice calling out to me, brighter than the sun. So this idea of optimism, of nature imagery, which is associated with the, you know, look at the entire country, and has a long tradition in American song. So I think that it really wasn't a bad choice. I mean, there's a lot that works.
People really didn't like it, though, and she's no longer using that song for one of the reasons that you said, that Celine Dion's Canadian, and also this was a song written for an airline, but I think it was more just the general tone of the song that people didn't like.
Mm-hmm. That could very well be that, you know, people didn't respond to it. It may have been a little early. It seemed like she was jumping the gun, especially as Obama has risen in the polls, and the idea of her sort of early coronation maybe offended some people. I think where I thought it was very astute, at least worked, at least initially, was in the video that was online, which had a lot of compelling images of Hillary Clinton and really using the words in very effective ways. And the idea of having your supporters pick your song is, I think, was a nice sort of publicity stunt for her. But, yeah, it hasn't certainly not continued and picked up momentum.
Of course, the idea of letting people help with it also led to a lot of kind of poking in the ribs on the internet. People suggested, you know, fake songs, including Man Eater by Hall & Oates, Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want by The Smiths, and some other stuff along those lines, including one by the Rolling Stones that we can't mention on the air. So not sure that was a successful tactic in letting the people pick the song.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Gordon.
It fits in with the current fad for reality shows, getting people to participate in some fashion with this. Even certain stores are doing it against themselves. For example, there's a campaign ads that are being created by users who are running against Subway Sandwich from the other company, whatever. What's the name of that other company that does similar Subway sandwiches?
There's Cousins,
right now.
There's
Quiznos.
Quiznos.
So Quiznos is running ads that are created by, you know, a game just like the way you're talking about, against the Subway sandwich. Anyway, so it's a very popular idea to get the audience involved. People get involved, the audience increases. It's working, and it fits in with the reality show concept of today.
Let's go back to the phones now and take a call from Dave calling from Menominee. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Hi. I have two images of your theme. One is, I was watching the night that Bill Clinton came out playing the sax with the shades on, and that worked for me. I knew right then this guy had me. And then I have an image of Hillary doing the Macarena, and I just wanted to take a baseball bat like John Belushi in Animal House did with the guitar and beat my television. It just did not work for me at all.
What was the difference? Can you put your finger on it?
No, I can't, but I think that sums up the Clintons in a nutshell right there, you know.
So you liked the Clinton with the sax, but not so much Hillary dancing.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Dave. We appreciate that. And
sure.
And Courtney Brown, had you seen the image that our caller is talking about there of Hillary doing the Macarena?
Actually, no, but I am aware of the... I have heard about it. I haven't seen it. The thing that you're talking about is actually where a candidate tests certain things just to see how it goes, and the things that don't work, they just discard. And political music is very much like that. It has to be tested, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The Celine Dion song was a good example of that. And in fact, this is true of all aspects of political campaigns. The use of Bill Clinton in South Carolina to raise the race question, the race issue, that was, and to be sort of the mean guy in South Carolina, that was actively supported by the by the Clinton campaign. They were talking about the good cop, bad cop idea, and they were actually planning on having Bill Clinton continue that after South Carolina. It's only when it didn't work that suddenly they turned it off and said, oh, that was just a rogue husband who was doing things. So this is a very common aspect of political campaigns. You try something, you see how it works. Now, ideally, you do it with a focus group so that you don't try it literally on the entire populace of the United States. That can really cost you. But sometimes you just can't you can't know, and you just try something, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and you just get rid of it as quick as possible.
So you sort of have to toss the dice and hope it's not going to be too damaging if it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Can you put your finger on, Mark Clegg, why Clinton with the sacks did work for so many people?
I think it's really interesting about the whole notion of leadership. I mean, Bill Clinton playing a jazz tune, and again, you have sort of some racial imagery there, but with African Americans being very, you know, the most prominent artists in jazz, but the sax solo, the saxophone solo, the sort of the creativity, the spontaneity, but also the leadership that comes out of the soloist, this idea of someone, you know, spinning a tune that everyone else is drawn to, as opposed to doing a dance that's a big, huge line dance, which I guess you can see is sort of uniting the country, but the individual gets lost in the group, you know, as opposed to the solo jazz artist. And I think that the sort of presidential associations with this, the soloist, with the leader who's out in ahead, who's doing something profound, which would be the sort of notion of the jazz solo, as opposed to being sort of lost in the line, is not the image we see in our president. So it worked for Bill, didn't work for Hillary.
It also worked for Bill in the very same sense that you see certain types of music working for Barack Obama right now. It's that younger crowd that Bill Clinton was really drawing. He was bringing new people into the electorate at that particular time, and playing the sax was not really attracting people who were older, but attracting people who were younger. And dancing the Macarena, or even trying to sing, which Hillary's done a couple times and forced her not to do again, that would be an attempt to sort of do something musical or something associated with music, but it doesn't have that she's not really going after the young people. Her real audience is not that younger, especially educated crowd that's really attracting Barack Obama. So, but Bill Clinton, that was his audience. Younger people, newly mobilized, that was a very strong element of the Clinton campaign.
Well, we're talking about Barack Obama there, so let's listen to one more that he is using on the road. And in the meantime, we do have a couple of open lines right now, so do give us a call and tell us what you think about your favorite campaign theme songs, and maybe looking back, what music has worked for you in terms of helping you connect to a candidate, and what made you go a little crazy because it just was not happening. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We're happy to hear from you this hour. In the meantime, here is a selection from the Obama campaign.
Neon hot day glow eyes, city lit by fireflies, they're advertising in the skies for people like us.
An upbeat song there. That's a U2 song called City of Lights. How do you think that one works, Mark Clegg?
Well, I think it's the energy, but also Bono and U2 being so associated with sort of liberal causes and with international liberal causes, and this idea of reaching out to different parts of the world, which I think is so much in the background of changing the relationship of the United States to other countries, being seen more as a partner. And I think that sort of Obama's international, you know, heritage, being at least raised outside the country, and then sort of connects with sort of Bono's image of sort of the world caregiver.
And do you agree with that, Courtney Brown?
Yeah, actually, that's a great comment. The only thing I might add to that is that it's interesting not just to look at the songs that they are using, but also the types of songs that they are not using. For example, they're not using songs that reference change, such as The Times They Are Changing by Bob Dylan, because they reference other aspects, other elements. They come with a little bit of baggage that's a little bit more tumultuous. Came out of the Vietnam War idea. The society was in turmoil. And Obama wants to present himself as a healer, as someone who brings people together. And some songs bring out the idea of change, but they also remind us a little bit too much of how much pain we may be in. And so it's interesting to see that the spin he's using, the choice of songs he's using, has got not so much of a negative diagnostic of where we are, but a positive uplift of where we need to go.
Let's take a call now. Here is Diana calling from Milwaukee. Welcome, Diana. You're on the air.
Hi. Speaking of kind of piggybacking on the change thing in the songs, I know that Carrie, I was at a rally in Madison, and Carrie had Sheryl Crow there. And her main thing that she was singing was, "A change will do you good." And I think you're right on with that. They don't want to bring the change element out in their song as much as maybe they have in the past. Also, I was at a really good rally in Madison with Bruce Springsteen for Carrie, and it was a street rally, and I mean, that was, like, fabulous. They had all the students from Madison hanging off the porches and everything, and I think anything to do with America is what people kind of get inspired with right now, you know, like the old James Brown song, "Living in America." I think those are ones that just people want to get excited, and especially with the Obama campaign, I've gotten to personally, you know, meet, shake his hands, have my picture taken, and people are just like totally, they want to get uplifted, and that's what's going on right now.
Okay, thanks for that call, Diana.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Diana from Milwaukee, and she has experienced the music firsthand, and it seems as though having that sort of extra sort of oomph behind the candidates really helps power their message up.
Yeah, I think Diana speaks to the kind of energy that these songs produce among a candidate's supporters and being used at rallies, and there's a lot more music happening because you're waiting for the candidate to show up, and you know the candidate's leaving, there's all this excitement, you want to capture that in some way, and using music in this kind of ritualistic way, the way music might be used in church to sort of control movements of crowds, and there are all sorts of very practical things about this music, but that energy and excitement is clearly a big part of it. I really liked Courtney's idea about the sort of avoiding issues, and one thing that's interesting to me is that we're talking about campaign songs, and in a sense the presidential campaign, you know, we don't even haven't chosen the candidates yet, so we're still really early. So I think that's another reason why there's a lot of variety of songs out there, and we're avoiding issues because I don't think the candidates are sure what are going to be the specific issues, and you don't want to have a song that locks you into something that you can't silence the echoes of down the road, because next week something may happen. And so I think this that he brought up earlier about trying out ideas and also makes people want to stay safe and not commit to any particular focus.
Let's take a call now from Ed in Oshkosh. Thanks for calling, Ed. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I wanted to say that the music that they're using for the campaigns, it's so heavy-handed, and you know, it's from the past. It's something that it's denuded of music felicity. You know, I mean, if you go out and listen to what people who make music now are doing, I mean, that's why it's keeping a lot of young people away from this election. It's just so corny and heavy-handed and obvious, you know, like Bill Clinton's saxophone solo that's nothing to do with jazz, it's nothing to do with creativity. Bill Clinton is no Billie Holiday. You know, whereas like some of Dylan's good stuff or Frank Zappa, you will do as you are told until the rights to you are sold. You know, the whole scene seems so heavy-handed and corny. It reminds me of Germany in the 31 through 39 when there was a constant state of emergency and, you know, things were really locked in the slots where, you know, you really had to go for it in a particular slot. That's where exactly you were directed. I can see why a lot of young people that I meet when I go out and listen to creative music that's happening now, you know, I just turned away by the whole scene, like people in Brazil that would vote for a foot powder for president. You know what I mean? It's that's my feeling of it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Ed. We appreciate that. Courtney Brown, did you want to respond quickly?
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting point in the following sense, that the music that is being used today is for packaging. It's for packaging candidates in an associational fashion, meaning they're trying to associate the mood, the spirit of the music with some type of emotional quality that they want the audience to believe they would bring to the White House. And that's much different than a lot of very directly representational political music actually is. For example, take Chile during the 1970s, when you had Salvador Allende being challenged by the rightist forces in Chile. What he used is he actually made a deal with some groups, Quiapayon, Illimani, Victor Jara, to actually go out and to sing songs that had direct political messages in them so as to educate the peasant masses. Similarly, Bob Marley used to use...
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in and
leave
it there. We could go on for a long time. It's a great topic, and I want to thank you so much for joining me. Talking with Mark Clegg, Assistant Professor of Musicology and American Culture at the University of Michigan, and Courtney Brown, Professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University. I'm Veronica Rickert, filling in this hour for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.